you look at those people and say, wait a minute, there would be social pressure, I mean, in a good sense, put on people that, you know, hey, we're going to, you know, you got, we want to go to this meeting and decide on what we're going to do in this region with power, with you know, with should we have more wind power, more solar, whatever. You haven't been working lately on our projects, you know, that we all decided we wanted to do. I don't know if you should really go to this meeting or not, you know, even if you want to go. I don't know if you've really earned it or whatever, or just something more simple as, I'm not going to talk to you because you're not cooperating, you're not helping with the with building things, with making a better life. You know, the I mean, what people are social animals. How long is someone going to exist sitting out a society, a whole society improving itself? How long is that going to feel good? How long is that going to be? That's going to really help you find somebody to be partners with, or help you get into a family situation or something like that. It's, yeah, being not doing anything. Sure, people are going to love that. You know, that's just gonna be fine under socialism. Are you nuts? Are you crazy? It's not coercion. It's discussion and you know, like, come on, you know, pull your weight in society, basically. Not with a threat of prison or anything like that. Just with, like, you're not doing the right thing. And a lot of things under capitalism, you can see a lot of arguments of people, the way they share out tasks on, devolve or evolve into that kind of discussion. You know, I don't convince other people to help me, or other people don't, or I don't help other people through penalty of prison or arrest. You know, it's a discussion. It's a hey, what, you know, I do this for you, you do this for me, blah, blah, blah. We're doing this for everybody. And that motivates us. You know, there are people now, again, going back to the socialist movement that are trying to change things. And we're going to give some statistics here in a second, based on motivation through, we will have a better life than under capitalism, and we'll save the planet for human habitation, where that's endangered under capitalism right now. Anyway, we have to give our legal ID here. We're WMFO Medford, or WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform, commercial free community based radio, and Social Alternative Radio, which you're listening to now. And I'm your host, Jeff, and another shout out to Diego, volunteer co-host, couldn't make it today. Hope you're feeling better, Diego. And also, we're known as Tufts Educational Radio sometimes. Yeah. And we're at 91.5 FM, WMFO, over the air, go out, like, you know, on the radio airwaves around Somerville, Medford, parts of Greater Boston. And we are also online at WMFO.org. Go to schedule, click on the show you want to hear. If it's not the show that's currently playing, there's another way to click on the show that's currently playing, but if you want a show that is not currently playing, you go to the archive function, and shows are kept for 2 weeks. Social Alternative Radio, by the way, is on every other week, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Sundays, so we're only going to have probably one show archived if all went well with that. And if it didn't, let us know. We're on Facebook at Socialist Alternative Radio. You can always contact us that way. You can contact the station, whatever. So I got this article here by a guy who, I got to be honest, I don't normally like this guy, this guy's work, John Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S, from The Nation. He's fond of doing what I criticized earlier, of calling liberal capitalism and liberalism, basically, and reformism, calling that democratic socialism or socialism. And he's dead wrong about that. But that's what he's into. And but I found an article that he wrote, and that he just pulled together some stats that I liked, that I wanted to talk about briefly. And here's a quote from his article. This is from, actually, I think I printed it out without getting much of the citation here. It's from The Nation, John Nichols, but I'm trying to give you the date, and I'm not sure I have it, which stinks. Nope. As I've complained on the show before, I don't know why, but people set up these websites and stuff where you print something out, and the stuff you really want in it, some of it, like the citation of date and title and so on, doesn't print out. Oh, thank you very much. So anyway, sometime in The Nation within the last couple weeks, I think it was, quote, the numbers don't tell us, okay, let's not read the whole thing here. 37% of Americans now view socialism positively. Now, that's out of the whole population, according to a Gallup survey from last year. And among the rising generation of voters, the numbers are substantially higher. Americans aged 18 to 29 are as positive about socialism, 51%, as they are about capitalism, 45%. Well, I would say that they're more positive about socialism. So that's, again, John Nichols is seems to be an inherently conservative author, even though he talks about socialism a lot. So you had 18 to 29-year-olds positive about socialism, 51%. 18 to 29-year-olds positive about capitalism, only 45%. That is a 12-point decline in young adults' positive views of capitalism in just the past 2 years, and a market shift since 2010 when you had 18 to 29-year-olds 68% viewing capitalism positively. That's during a so-called boom period where supposedly, and I'd say there's a grain of truth in this, it's slightly easier, but I will qualify it was slightly easier to find a job over the last couple of years, but a job that can pay, it's a whole other deal. The rest of it is... rest of the article is Nichols doing his thing of equating liberalism with socialism, which really does not help us, John. John, hey, you need a crash course in what real socialism is. And again, that whole question, which we come back to a lot here, is what is real socialism and so on. I'm not saying it's sort of easy to always say what it is and what it isn't. For example, in Europe, you have a plethora, if that's the right word, and other countries, of parties that did start out revolutionary. Often called social democratic parties, that started out, their history was total break with the capitalist political system. Raised their own money, protests, strikes, mass movements, got their way into the electoral system, right? Like to say the British Labour Party back at the turn of the 20th century. And started off, their goal being socialism, and their goal being... whether it was completely state or not, revolutionary socialism, they were wanted a major change, a fundamental change. Fast forward to now, and starting really in the 50s and 60s, but elements of it even propping up in the 20s and 30s, among some social, and even in World War One, among some social democratic parties, a lot of them sort of became, over time, moved to the right, became pro-capitalist, ditching a lot of their, both formally and informally, ditching a lot of their socialist goals, and even entering into governments that, were capitalist governments, basically, right? And so other left-wing parties emerged that were to the left of those and so on, but we won't get into that right now. So it's a little difficult, though, when you look at a social democratic party and say, that can be argued somewhat, is there any chance of this worker, how deeply embedded is this workers' party, a social democratic party in Europe, for example, say the British Labour Party, in with capitalism? Now, as recently as the 90s, when Blair was in power, you could say the British Labour Party had sort of, what's that phrase, that old phrase, jumped the shark. It had changed so dramatically or something, or I don't know why I'm using that phrase. It had changed so dramatically that it was both pro-capitalist and getting some money from the capitalists. So the British Labour Party was, as some people said in Britain, bourgeoisified, like in the CWI, Committee for Workers International. British Labour Party is bourgeoisified. We need a new workers' party in Britain. And there were attempts to form new workers' parties. And in some regional areas, there are other workers' parties in Britain to the left of the Labour Party, way to the left, in a good sense. And however, this weird thing happened where this guy, Ed Miliband, who wanted to be just like Blair and was just like Blair, he saw that the party had social democratic parties had membership bases. Now, unlike the Democratic and Republican parties, actual members. You become a member, and then you're in a local party grouping of some sort, and you can actually sort of, on paper at least, vote and influence directly party policy, elect who will run as candidates, and all sorts of things. Now, at times, they've totally hollowed out and removed that internal democracy. British Labour Party still had some little bit of internal democracy in it, and Miliband got the idea that they needed an infusion of cash. They were getting money from, I think they were getting money from big business at the time, but it wasn't enough, and they were getting less votes. They've been out of power. They just lost an election, blah blah blah. They didn't want to be irrelevant anymore. So, and they still had this like weak membership base that was basically kept out of doing anything real, and it just dwindled. So Miliband's like, hey, let's open up the party, get some money in. And I think it was like a very low rate of membership, like £3 or something, or £5. I don't remember the exact amount. And come and join the Labour Party, right? And at the same time, they're figuring out who's going to replace Ed Miliband because he had lost an election. And they went around to some the room and the Labor Party executive, and nobody wanted to do it. Then they pointed to, and then they, there was Jeremy Corbyn sitting in the back. This is a true story based on an eyewitness account that I heard, where the Corbyn's in the back reading some lefty paper. And I mean that in a good sense. I mean that in a good rah-rah solidarity sense. Corbyn's in the back reading a lefty paper, listening to all this, listening to each Labor Party bigwig say no, they're more interested in joining the firm of such and such. They don't want to run, you know, for power. So again, Labor Party by 2000s and starting even way before that, but certainly in the 90s and 2000s had been bourgeoisified, early 2000s. So this is like a few years ago. So Corbyn is like, puts down his paper or looks over the paper and says, I'll do it. So Corbyn gets picked to run. Now, Corbyn's an old lefty in a lot of senses, a bit of a socialist, for real, more so than Sanders or AOC. Because he's never been in a true capitalist party. He's been in a Labor Party, which devolved into a pro-capitalist sort of bourgeoisified Labor Party, as we were saying, if you want to use a fancy term. So Corbyn happens to say that those magic words, I'll do it, just as they're letting in a lot of people, including a lot of young people, into the party for the first time, opening up membership because they want the money and because they want, they're desperate and they made a mistake. Frankly, the right-wing Labor Party is kicking itself right now. Why the heck did we open up why did we open up to membership again? They're just kicking themselves for that because all these young people pissed off at years of conservative rule in Britain started joining the Labor Party. So that's my original point was, it's when you're judging social democratic parties that have a history originally of being revolutionary parties and somewhat of a history of being independent of capitalist money and to the left, truly to the left, much more left. The Democratic Party in the United States is not a social democratic party. Bernie Sanders is not a social democrat. He's never been in a social democratic party. Social democratic party, you know, has certain criteria in terms of political independence from where it gets its resources, at least, and certainly ideologically, that the Democratic Party is just totally not that. It's just a capitalist party. So Corbyn, Jeremy Corbyn, gets the nod and runs with it a bit. And people that were inside the party hanging on or people who are outside the Labour Party rejoin and start to try to turn it left again. And that process is happening right now. And it's not the best process totally because the right wing has a lot of money. You know, they've got ties to big business. And they're fighting Corbyn every step of the way. The latest thing is they say, because Corbyn's against U.S. imperialist intervention in Venezuela, he's defending a dictator, they say, which is a complete lie. Maduro's not a dictator, which we'll get into in a minute. Neither is Venezuela socialist, by the way. Another big lie. But anyway, so the media, the right-wing Labour Party, and so on, they're really after Corbyn and the left that's ascendant now in the British Labour Party and could win an election that might have even come recently when this whole Brexit thing was being debated. An election was almost called. What prevented the Conservatives from tossing May out totally was they saw that Corbyn might win an election, so et cetera, et cetera. And the point, though, is just simply that, look, some of these parties that have sold out, if they started out really to the left, if they were really left parties, mass workers parties, with, you know, real memberships and real socialist ideology, you can't always say for sure when they've bit the dust, when they're completely useless to working people. And that's different in different countries. Here in the U.S., we never had that party. We had a socialist party that was growing. Whether it was a mass party or not, I would say it was a mass party, but it needed to grow more. It had socialist party members around the turn of the 20th century had been elected to many, and years after that, up until World War I, had been elected to many local offices. It was kind of a loose party, though. I would say you could make an analogy to a social democratic party, but one that was even kind of more heterogeneous, is that the right word? Heterogeneous, sorry. I haven't used that word in a while. Heterogeneous. Than the European social democratic parties. It had a lot of, for example, like in some places, professionals like involved, and that destroyed its class content. In other places, it was very working class. A lot of places had immigrant sections, but then they had the immigrant section separate, which wasn't a good idea. Anyway, you've probably heard of Eugene Debs. If you haven't, look it up. Debs, Eugene Debs. He was the most well-known spokesperson for the Socialist Party. And he actually ran for president from prison. They threw him in prison for speaking out against World War I, which a Democrat, Woodrow Wilson, made illegal. The Wilson regime, viciously racist, viciously pro-imperialist, brought the U.S. into World War I and then made it illegal to say anything against that or against the draft. And Deb spoke against the draft, was thrown in prison, in federal prison, very harsh conditions as an old man. And yet he survived prison. Actually, the prisoners kind of rallied around him for the most part. And he survived. And he ran for president from prison and got hundreds of thousands of votes. And at the time, a very large percentage for someone running for prison, like 4 to 5% of the vote nationally, and became well known for that, became a hero to many working people, forced the Wilson, I think it was the Wilson regime or the regime after, I forget who, did pardon Debs finally under pressure. And anyway, the point is, look up Eugene Debs, not for any sort of hero worship or anything, but just to get an entree to engage with, wrestle with what the Socialist Party was in the United States. But hey, that was a long time ago, and it sort of died out in the 20s for the most part, and moved to the right politically, made it useless in the 30s, which, you know, called for, obviously, very left politics to just, you know, working people had to fight to survive. And the Communist Party, the new Communist Parties, and there were two of them at first in the 20s in the United States, took, you know, all the Socialist Party people just joined the Communist Party, any that were any good and interested in real change. But then the Communist Party became Stalinized in the late 20s, early 30s, and its orders from Russia were to support the Democratic Party for the most part, all but except one election in the 30s. And then that one election, they were being very ultra-left and didn't support other formations that could have been a broad mass left party in the United States led by the Communist Party or supported by the Communist Party, some sort of labor party in the United States. And there almost was in some regions. But the Communist Party stuck to its support, liberal Democrats, trying to get a good deal for Russia under Stalin. It was no longer interested in a revolution. And that really set back politics in the United States. We never had the Social Democratic period for real, right? Socialist Party never took power nationally, even never came close. It wasn't mass party enough. Then the Communist Party that was approaching mass, you know, it had like around 100,000 members at one point. It had control over, had been elected into leadership in the AFL-CIO locals, 49% of them around the country. This is by around 1938. And yet, rather than cashing all that in for as being part of a united front towards a workers' party of some sort, or even just trying to form one itself, it voted for the Democrats and urged people to vote for Roosevelt and kept the Democrats in power, helped keep the Democrats in power, even as its rank and file was doing, you know, good work in certain areas in terms of organizing and so on, not really aware of the whole Stalinist thing and or going along with it, unfortunately. And then there's a counter, people trying to organize against Stalinism became known as Trotskyists and so on in the 30s. And that started to grow in the 30s into the 40s, but never and did support a labor party. But again, the Communist Party dominated. And then back to under the McCarthy era and the Cold War, a lot of liberals, like with the New Left, moved into the Democratic Party like they are now, radicals that could have helped build a some sort of third party for working people, of working people, hopefully, and so on, went into the Democratic Party. In fact, I even heard today AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, referred to as the New Left. And I thought, that's a very apt, very, very correct in some ways label, because she is doing, as a self-proclaimed socialist, she really isn't, but she says she is, Democratic socialist. And what Sanders is doing is what the New Left did. They went and entered the Democratic Party. All the radical hippies and yippies and all that stuff, they saw no, they made no serious attempts to organize anything outside of the Democratic Party politically. Even the civil rights movement eventually ended up there, Mississippi Freedom Party and so on. It was all about reforming the Democrats. And, you know, depending on how you, depending on what your goal is, if your goal is as a liberal to remain under capitalist rule, then perhaps their reforms were somewhat successful. If your goal is, hey, the vast, literally millions of working people that never vote because there's nothing out there for them, if your goal is to have a party that challenges capitalism, that wants to have democratic, real democratic socialism, and you need to build that, then this was a disaster, of course, to have all the radical energy, which didn't reach into the working class totally. It was primarily upper middle class student-led movements in the 1670s, but some working class participation. If all that political energy had been taken into building a third party, even if it was a kind of a mess, because you had the class, you didn't have the working class, you'd have to get the working class more involved than it was. The working class was very involved in the 60s and 70s in the anti-Vietnam War movement within the army. And if you read about that, it's a mind-blowing thing that you had the self-organization of working people in being drafted in this ridiculously horrible war, the biggest imperialist power in the world going after the Vietnamese people. And I'm not defending the Stalinist regime in Vietnam at all. I'm just saying it was war against the people, whether it was in the North or even in the South, the covert wars by the CIA and the South Korean dictatorships and so on. If you find yourself over in Vietnam or even back here, and you are and you're becoming awakened to radical politics, because one of the good things the New Left did in the 1970s, and there were good things, obviously, just they made the hugest, biggest, dumbest mistake of trying to reform the Democrats and set everything back and kept everything safely under capitalist hands. I mean, imagine that moment where you had Nixon on the ropes, right? And you had the Democrats. So the Democrats run McGovern, and a lot of the hippies and so on support, the New Left type support McGovern when AFL-CIO leadership, which was right wing, wouldn't support McGovern. A lot of Democrats voted Republican. Like, it's just ridiculous to try to stay within the two capitalist party paradigm, the duopoly, as it's referred to here in the U.S., the capitalist duopoly over politics between the Democratic and Republican parties, to stay within that at a time of such radicalization that produced a huge upsurge in the women's movement, a huge upsurge in the environmental movement, and of course the success of the anti-war movement, relative success of the anti-war movement, ending the Vietnam War, getting U.S. troops out and so on, at least stopping the draft temporarily. But what I was getting at is the working class component of that was mostly, not entirely, but mostly with a lot of working class kids getting drafted and then learning ways to organize against that here in basic training or over in Vietnam itself very effectively. And if you don't believe me, go back and read the books that came out and the articles that came out of the Vietnam War, right as it was ending and right afterwards, before sort of the big chill set in and the whole revisionism under Reagan about the war started up, aided and abetted by the New York Times. So I read Jerry Lemke's work, Lemke. He was a professor out at Holy Cross, I think, and recently retired. He wrote a book called, it's a funny name, called The Spitting Image, not the British TV show from a while back, but this book called The Spitting Image, where he's got other books too. It just, and he was in Vietnam, takes apart the revisionist history that was so popular in the 80s and 90s, and even today to a certain extent, about the Vietnam War. Just outright lies, like troops came back and were spit on. Never happened. Never happened. And every source that said it happened is completely not credible, but it's become an urban myth repeated by the New York Times and other corporate media outlets. And Lemke, like a detective, an academic detective, he studies these incidences and finds every single one he studied was false. And others have studied other incidents and found out they were false. And that's just one little example of the mythology that grew up around the Vietnam War, and that the crazy movies like The Deer Hunter and all the Rambo stuff and all that, that just rewrote the Vietnam War as some sort of the Vietnamese as some sort of crazed subhumans and the heroic U.S. soldiers. Even something, even a movie like Platoon was just ridiculous in terms of what was really going on in Vietnam among the soldiers, who were so well organized at some points that entire battalions were taken offline, so to speak, where the troops refused to follow orders, and any officers that demanded or started to demand that the troops go into very dangerous controlled areas, areas controlled by the NVA or the Viet Cong, the troops would say no and back that up with some pretty violent actions called fragging. And you can look that up if you want. But basically, this huge revolt happened. And I knew someone personally who was in Socialist Alternative for a while, who organized a troop revolt at a, I think it was somewhere in Massachusetts. I forget the name of the place where they had they were training people to go overseas. And he helped organize a troop revolt against the war, to the point where they just wrote off the entire sort of class of soldiers there, said we can't send any of them over to Vietnam, they'll just agitate the hell out of the place. And a few people were discharged and the rest were sent to other places, not Vietnam. Anyway, that's a bit of a digression, but the original point was, a political party for working people, and when and how that, how there were times in the 20th century, recent 20th century, that we could have had that, at least that Social Democratic Party, at least that party or mass left party, and if we had that, we would probably have national health care right now. We would probably have all sorts of social benefits that are so uniquely Americanly not available to us: free education, national health care, subsidized child care, better mass transit, all that kind of stuff. And by the way, the countries that have gotten that, Canada, Britain, most countries in Europe, or all countries in Europe, basically, et cetera, in other countries as well. I'm not saying that like Sanders would say that, oh, but so that's socialism. It's not socialism. It's hard-won reforms under capitalism by socialist movements and mass movements around those things, usually led and populated by socialists of some sort to a great extent. But those things can be taken away, and they are. If you're familiar with British politics right now, for example, there's been decades of underfunding of the National Health Service there on purpose. Now, the Conservatives will get out and say the National Health Service is so popular in Britain, as is national health care in Canada, that even Conservative parties are afraid to directly attack it. They'll say, we're for the NHS. Yeah, no problem. Then they'll do elaborate measures in the legislature to underfund it and to set up private systems that they can then point to and say, oh, at least the rich can go there, right? And say, well, this is our future, a privatized mixed or whatever, or just privatized. If they get their courage up and say that, every once in a while, some conservative in Britain will say, we don't need the NHS, look at this private thing over here. And people will react like, what? Quiet. No, what are you saying? Even some of the conservatives will say, shut up, not yet. But they're constantly underfunding it. No reform is safe under capitalism. Every social benefit that you think is yours, it's going to be yours forever. Like people, if you go back to the 60s and 70s, the kind of grant funding here in the United States, even for college, people were given grants a lot. You don't pay back a grant. It's not a loan. It's a grant. The price of university being so low, plus grant funding, you did have an increase in working class people going to college. And even now, you have a pretty high rate in the United States, maybe 55%, something like that, that go to some sort of college. Guess how many get degrees, though, like the standard four-year degree? You're down to 25%, and it's falling. So, every reform won under capitalism, if you're still under capitalism, can be taken away by the capitalists because they see a new profit-making opportunity, or they see something they don't want to invest in. Either one, If they can't figure out a way to profit monger, a way to make money off it, off of something, then they're not going to invest in it. Anyway, let's. We promised earlier we're going to talk about Venezuela, and the time has flown, so we're going to get into it a little bit now. This is an article I wanted to reference some things from that is actually written by a Canadian. Now, why start there? Well, I don't know, because it's a pretty good article, and because Canada sometimes gets a pass. I mean, I was just talking up the national healthcare system in Canada. Hey, Canada's like big, you strip down Canada to its essence, it's a big mining, big oil producing, natural resources pumping out place, you know? And it's an advanced capitalist country, so-called. It's industrialized. It's got more than that going on. But, you know, the essence of Canada is extraction of fossil fuels. And it's real spine, economic spine, so to speak. And it pollutes the heck out of itself. Canada is a very polluted place, even compared to the United States. And here we have Canada. We have this new liberal, Trudeau, in power. He's very handsome, youngish politician that people are that should know better are supporting, and he's a liberal. Now in Canada, again, you have the NDP, and if you're in Quebec, you have the Québec Solidaire. You have other parties that are independent of big business that you can vote for. The NDP is, I don't know if it's independent, you can say it's independent of big business anymore, but there's other left formations, and in Canada you have proportional representation and stuff, so you have political choices there, unlike here. It's more democratic in that sense. And yet this guy Trudeau got elected. So here we have a quote. This is by Maria Paez Victor, February 6, 2019, counterpunch.org. Bloody Canada, cheerleading the Lima Group's plot to overthrow the government of Venezuela. Opening sentence, Canada has become the cheerleader of the Lima Group, an ad hoc, self-appointed busybody group formed specifically to overthrow the legitimate government of Venezuela. Unable to get the OAS, Organization for American State, votes needed to agree to their plot. This is a group of governments with no official international standing, few democratic principles, most led by known discredited leaders spouting market ideology, capitalist ideology. Canada has aligned itself, throwing all of its diplomatic and economic support for a man who self-proclaimed himself president of Venezuela in a public plaza, violating the country's constitution and all electoral rules. This is the guy that's trying to become the new leader of Venezuela, and we'll get more into what he's about in a second. But first, a little general overview of what this author is talking about. So Canada is part of this Lima Group. You got Colombia. Quote, 65% of the world's cocaine production comes from Colombia. It's the world's most dangerous place for labor leaders due to their ongoing assassination of rural indigenous leaders, and recently the assassination of leaders of the FARC, who laid down their arms in a peace treaty. Paramilitary and narco mafia are rampant in Colombia. Peru, its president was not elected. Its former president had to be removed because of proven corruption by their own courts. Now, again, these are countries that are supporting U.S. imperialism going after Venezuela. Argentina, Macri is famously included in the Panama Papers for his corruption. His popularity is dramatically down, and he even jailed the Madres de la Plaza de Mayo, women seeking their lost children during the Pinochet era that have been protesting for decades in Argentina. Brazil, Bolsonaro, who we've talked about on the show before, extreme right wing, has become president. Some people call him fascist. That's debatable, but he's horrible enough either label. He's president only because he jailed his key opponent who led the polls, Lula. And Bolsonaro has boasted of giving the police the right to shoot to kill anyone they suspect are criminals. Suspect. That's like the Philippine autocrat that's in power right now. Bolsonaro is a blatant extremist. He has declared that the Amazon is now, quote, open for business, unquote, and will allow developments there. So there goes more of the rainforest, which is already has been destroyed to a great extent in Brazil. Paraguay, another part of the Lima Group, its president came to power through a judicial coup d'etat. Freeland, a throwback to the Cold War, has trashed the former dignified, independent foreign policy. Wait a minute, who's he talking about now? The author. Anyway, I'm going to skip that just for time's sake. We're running out of time here. Now, President Maduro, the current president of Venezuela, was reelected in the May 20th, 2018 presidential elections, in which six opposition candidates took part, supported by 16 opposition parties. Just because three opposition parties chose not to participate by their own decision does not invalidate the election. And I'm saying, I'm going into the details here because I don't hear these details in the corporate media. They don't give them. The corporate media, the crudest pro-imperialist propaganda I've ever heard, anti-Venezuelan and just crude, like, forget any sense of democracy, any sense of justice, like National Propaganda Radio, NPR. I want a boycott on that thing. I want people to not give money to that thing. And I know that a lot of liberals will be offended by that. Even some socialists I know, they love NPR. I don't know why. It is so right-wing now, especially in terms of Venezuela. It's just mouthing off stuff that's to the right of even other corporate media outlets. It's ridiculous. It's the Fox News now, as far as Venezuela goes, on NPR, National Propaganda Radio. I hate them. And really, people should not, there should be no public money going to National Propaganda Radio. And people should boycott National Propaganda Radio. And not just because of Venezuela, because of, if you follow NPR, as I do, their money's coming from the Koch brothers now. It's coming from Joan Kroc, the McDonald's widow, or what's left of her estate. Their fundraising is just icing on the cake. They get their money from old corporate money now. And it's reflected in things like, check out National Propaganda Radio on charter schools. They are blatant propagandists for charter schools, which are schools, private schools, run on public money and siphoning money away from the public schools. Siphoning is too nice a word. Stealing money away from the public schools. And there's other issues as well. But in Venezuela, it's so clear that NPR is a pro-capitalist, completely corporate station. Now, that might sound like to a hardened leftist, and I mean that in a good sense. Yeah, what's he talking about? Everyone knows that. Well, no, everyone doesn't know that. I'm surprised at people that will defend National Propaganda Radio. It's just ridiculous. And listen to its coverage on Venezuela. It's absurd. It is absurd what it says. Anyway, so that's why I'm giving some of these facts. So in this election, May 20th, 2018, Maduro got 6.3 million votes, 67% of the vote. Henry Falcón got 1.9 million votes, 20.9%. And Javier Bertucci got 996,181 votes, 10.8%. You add 10.8, you get around 31% versus 67% or 6.3 million votes for Maduro. The losing candidates all accepted the results as valid. The 150 international independent observers all accepted the election process as clean and transparent, including Mayor Anthony Witherspoon of Magnolia, Mississippi. And there's a link to a video if you go find this article in Counterpunch. As I said, this is I'm quoting some of this from Maria Paez Victor, February 6, 2019. Counterpunch article called Bloody Canada Cheerleading the Lima Group's Plot to Overthrow the Government of Venezuela. Now, a comparison with other regional presidents show that Nicolas Maduro had a higher percentage of votes than they. So Maduro gets 67%. Trump only got 46%. Macri in Argentina, 2015, 51.2. Santos, where's Santos from? I don't have to check on that. 2014, 53.1%. Pinera, 2017, 54.6%. None of them come close to Maduro. Now, with electoral process that Jimmy Carter declared the best in the world, by the way, I don't really like Carter that much. I can explain why sometime, but we can talk about that. But he is doing his thing lately of poll watching in various places. So electoral process that Jimmy Carter declared the best in the world, how does this make President Maduro illegitimate? The voting process has an electronic fingerprint and paper trail, practically fraud-proof, and is the same system used in 2015 when the opposition gained the most votes for the legislature, and indeed in which Guaido, and that's the guy we were talking about earlier, the erstwhile, want to become unelected dictator, and I mean dictator of Venezuela. And Maduro is not a dictator. And by the way, I'm not like all rah-rah Maduro, and neither is Social Alternative, or a lot of socialists are like, and you'll see why Maduro, maybe we won't have time actually, but the we talked about it last time, last show. Maduro tried to, you never had all the economy in Venezuela or all the biggest part of the economy under public or government control. So it wasn't socialism. And you had instead a mixed economy, quote unquote, where they had nationalized some things. Or like with the oil company, before Chavez got elected, by the way, going back to that time, oil was already a state thing, a nationalized thing in Venezuela. But it was run by a sort of little cartel or cabal, you could say, of business people that would take the profits and siphon them away from the people and into high salaries for themselves and the government. So Chavez came in and cleaned house and took a lot of the oil revenue for the first time and put it into social programs. But there were still a ton of other, you know, corporations around Venezuela that were not, and land that was not nationalized, and media that was not taken under public ownership. And so the capitalists just constantly went after Chavez, tried a coup in 2002. You should read about that. Was it 2002? I have to check on the date, exact date, but there's a movie you can get on YouTube for free called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, all about the failed coup against Chavez. This time, they're not trying again against Maduro, but unlike under Chavez, the coup attempt now that they're trying to do, they're trying to get rid of Maduro, is by years of sanctions by the United States, stealing of Venezuela, sanctions on the Venezuelan economy, more recently stealing of Venezuelan assets, gold assets in London based on a loan they had taken, oil assets, not allowing oil to be sold in the United States, and seizing all the oil assets in the United States, all the stuff that the Trump regime has done, on top of the sanctions that were already in place under Obama and other regimes, I believe. I don't know how far it goes back, at least the Obama regime. And a whole history, of course, of intervention in Central Latin America by U.S. imperialism that knocks countries into line. Chavez stood up against it. Maduro is standing up against it. Maduro's got a lot of problems. If I was a socialist in political solidarity with the CWI, there is a Community Workers International group in Venezuela, and they're not calling for like rah-rah Maduro. They're calling for a united front of the left, including people that might not like Maduro anymore but are truly socialist, but also Maduro supporters, to just have a mass united front as possible against U.S. imperialism and their puppet, this guy Guaido. And that's what I would be supporting down there. Not saying rah-rah Maduro, but that, you know, Guaido will be a step backward, obviously, and a lot of people will be murdered by the new regime, and the environment and the oil revenues and everything else will be destroyed. In fact, Guaido's is part of this party. Let me step back here. So the author here is saying that it's a farce that the quarrel with Venezuela is about illegitimacy and democracy. This is not even a coup d'etat. It's a blatant neocolonial war against Venezuela to reduce to a puppet state and take possession of its oil, gold, and other resources. These are modern pirates acting on behalf of corporate capital. No disagreement there. I'll add one thing. Venezuela has the highest proven reserves of oil in the entire world. You want to know why U.S. capitalism is so interested in Venezuela? Part of it's the whole region, keeping control of that. Part of it is, of course, hugely this oil, or the oil reserves in Venezuela, getting control of that, and the oils that the oil that's being produced. Furthermore, the USA has admitted it wants to, quote, take back Latin America, end quote, and intends to go after Cuba, Nicaragua, and Bolivia. As the Wall Street Journal so plainly said, U.S. push to oust Venezuela's Maduro marks first shot in plan to reshape America. Wall Street Journal, but no date given, sorry. The USA wants to put in their place those uppity Latinos who think they can have any sort of independent politics, do not agree with USA dominance of the hemisphere. There's a lot of racism as part of this. Also, the U.S. is alarmed at huge investments of China and Russia have made in Latin America. Now, Guaido, the imperialist puppet that went secretly to meet with Trump and get his blessing recently, Guaido's party is called Voluntad Popular, VP. It is the most violent and right-wing opposition party in Venezuela. One of its leaders, Maria Corina Machado, was interviewed on the public Canadian broadcasting company CBC on February 1st. She has openly, repeatedly, shamelessly, and in front of numerous TV and radio cameras, urged mobs to violence, and she has most recently publicly threatened the life of Maduro. She has also been invited to speak, I won't go into that, just speak with Ottawa politicians, whatever. So, this is about the Canadian complicity in what the U.S. and what U.S. imperialism is leading against Venezuela. Guaido and his party carried out the terrible street violence of 2014, which they named La Salida, the exit. It resulted in 114 innocent people being killed. Several young men were burned alive, suspected of being Chavistas. This was the worst street violence ever seen on the streets of Venezuela. The leader of the party, Leopoldo Lopez, was jailed after a long and fair trial with the best lawyers money can buy, sentenced for his responsibility for unleashing the terror and the ensuing 114 deaths. Did you hear about that in the corporate media? Did you hear that the right wing kills people in Venezuela? No, you don't. A simple Google search would have shown the videos and the street terror of the VP Unleashed, that's the party, the salient role Guaido, Lopez, and Machado played. Lopez and Machado are members of two of the country's richest families, key part of an elite that governed Venezuela for 40 years, using the oil revenues for their own enrichment, and left 80% of the people impoverished. That was before Chavez. I heard on the radio today also that Guaido has ties to American thing? It's a front, probably for the CIA, but it's something about blah, blah, democracy. I'll have to look it up. Sorry. I didn't take notes when I was listening to this thing. But anyway, he's been part of this kind of... You've heard of, like, the color revolutions, you know, like in Ukraine and Georgia and other places, even Libya, Syria. It's a group, Center for New Democracy, Center for... I don't know. Again, don't quote me on the name of the thing. But it's this institute that Guaido was hooked up to for years that... goes around and funds conservative destabilization of governments they consider left or out of the control of imperialism, even if they're right-wing, or whatever, not right-wing, but even if they're not really left. Guaido is a son of Spanish immigrants. He's a useful idiot, according to this author, a thug who will be thrown into the trash can of history, but he does command, he does not command any type of institution, not one policeman, not one ministry, not one official of any sort, but he's president in his own mind, and that of the U.S. Embassy, where apparently he was hiding out, or possibly still hiding out in. He doesn't need to hide, by the way, and he has been on the streets also, so I don't know if that's still happening, this thing. Skipping ahead, in opposing the legitimately elected presidency of Maduro and advocating for a bogus self-appointed CIA-trained puppet Guaido, there's three things that are in the wind being organized. A coup d'etat, possibly. A military intervention by USA, Colombian, or Brazilian troops, or all of them together. That could also be part of the first one. A civil war that can easily spiral into a regional war. And then again, this is a Canadian article, so what will Canadians want and what will they approve of? Let's see. Trump has stated, a gangster-like, that they want the country's resources. That is the Libya and Ukraine model, as I mentioned a minute ago in a different context. First, set up a parallel government. Secondly, stage a false flag, perhaps the murder of Guaido. Then invade and divide up the country's resources among the willing partners. Oh, yes, the loot. There is always promise of loot among conspirators. The U.S. hopes to dismember Venezuela like a giant cake. ExxonMobil wants the oil. The international banks want the gold. Colombia wants to control or possess the eastern oil-rich region next to its border. Brazil wants carte blanche for its big energy corporation. Guyana wants the Essequibo region on the eastern border handed to them, that is to ExxonMobil. And Paraguay wants the huge debt it owes to Venezuela to quietly disappear. And it's not a wild guess to think that Canada obtained its recent free trade deal with Trump as a quid pro quo, to lead the help lead the charge against Venezuela and get a deal there. And oil producers in Canada, mostly U.S.-owned, will shed no tears over the destruction of Venezuela's crude oil production. Make no mistake about it, these are the modern carpetbaggers. If any of these alternatives occur, coup, invasion, or civil war, there will be blood on the hands of Justin Trudeau and his cabinet as they play with fire and ignore international law. On the Canadian media that so irresponsibly failed to do their due diligence, and unfortunately in the hands of every Canadian that's ignored or looked away as outrageous this government is doing in their name, following obediently the USA neocolonial war of pillage against Venezuela. They'll have to live with the stain of whatever innocent blood is spilt for a long time, perhaps forever. So I thought I'd give that little Canadian perspective there. There's, of course, a lot of good material from on the alternate media. I've spent a lot of time in the last week basically... sharing on Facebook really good stuff, tearing down the lies about what the U.S. corporate media is saying about, including National Propaganda Radio, by the way, about what's happening in Venezuela, what are the roots of it, and so on. And so that's, you know, no shortage of stuff. I just thought I'd start with that article, and now we're practically out of time, so we're not going to get to some of the other ones. By the way, I also just shifting gears for 1 second. Brought in a book I want to talk about that I will not get time to talk about, but leave it to the next show. It's called A History of America in 10 Strikes by Eric Loomis. Just an interesting take, you know, looking at U.S. history through the labor movement to a certain extent. I don't think the author's much more than a liberal, but it's got some good good information in it, and I want to get into that a little bit. But we're going to save that for next time. Corporate Titans Target Venezuela. We're going to have to save that for next time. But we will jump into a little bit, continuing the theme of Venezuela. We'll end the show on this in the next few minutes. Yeah, I got a lot of good stuff. I knew I wasn't going to get to it all, but I thought I'd get some more. Anyway, Venezuela, the U.S.'s 68th regime. Oh, also, check out socialistworld.net and socialistalternative.org for a couple of articles I'm not going to have time to get into fully. One of them I talked about a little last time. It is called Venezuela for mass mobilization of workers to build real socialism and put an end to corrupt bureaucracy. From Venezuela, from Izquierda Revolucionario, the CWI, Committee for Works International in Venezuela. And that is from January 24th from socialistworld.net. Already got into that a little bit, maybe more next time on that. Also, international capitalism rallies behind Venezuela's right-wing opposition leader. Also from Venezuela, and that's from 4 February 2019, written by socialists. And I also had, I was going to interrupt some of the Venezuelan stuff. I was going to go into an article about Sweden and the new government's attacks on workers' rights. You know, that whole myth of Scandinavia being socialist and all that. I really wanted to expose that a little more. We already talked about it a little bit. And then I had a really good article. It's going to probably have to wait. Sinclair and the EPIC campaign, EPIC, Can We Capture the Democratic Party? It's an analysis of a historic event a lot of Americans aren't aware of, where Upton Sinclair, the famous author of The Jungle, was for many years in the Socialist Party. He jumped ship into the Democratic Party, deciding he had to do that, like Sanders has been saying, and ran for governor of California, and it got a lot of press. But so the article analyzes, did that work? Well, answer, just spoiler alert, no, it didn't. He didn't reform the Democratic Party. He did not get elected. But it talks about the context, the historical context in which he ran, much more radical than today. So I, you know, some people justify supporting Sanders and AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, and their I would call it a betrayal, a class betrayal, of working within the Democratic Party. And they say, well, it's the times that we're in. You know, there's more support for socialism and DSA is growing and all this other stuff. I'm like, are you kidding me? You had the new left and you had the mass radical movements of the 30s and into the 40s, where people faced the same decisions and went into the Democratic Party with much more of a chance to change it and reform it than now, and didn't get anywhere. In fact, they got co-opted, or they got kicked out, or they gave up and did not put their energy and time into building like other countries have, other lefts have in other countries, other left-wingers have in other countries, a true independent political voice for working people. Social democratic parties through communist, labor, socialist parties, whatever. So anyway, the last moments here, Counterpunch again. Counterpunch.org, article by Medea Benjamin, who's well-known feminist, anti-war activist, and Nicholas J.S. Davies, February 6, 2019, quote, Venezuela, the U.S.'s 68th regime change disaster. 68th regime change disaster. Now, they start off the article quoting or talking about a book called Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II by William Blum, B-L-U-M. Now, Blum was part of the New Left, kind of radical journalist type. Focusing though on really sort of this strange dichotomy, not strange, but I mean, you know, it's explainable, dichotomy between the severe propaganda, especially pro-imperialist propaganda in the United States versus the rest of the world, basically, and how the rest of the world views things. And he liked to expose, I've read some of his stuff, really obvious contradictions to any notion of democracy or justice through the abuse in the United States of not only mostly foreign countries and movements there through the CIA and so on, but also somewhat in the United States itself, because he was part of the New Left movements, anti-war movements and all that. Anyway, Blum died in December 2018, but back in that book that was published in 1995, Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions in World War II, he had already listed and analyzed 55 U.S. regime change operations against countries around the world, whether it's from China from the 45 to 1960s to Haiti, 1986 to 1994. And a lot's happened since 95, of course, even in Haiti, for example. So Medea Benjamin and this other author, Davies, mentioned at least 13 more regime change operations, several of which are still active. Quote, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Iraq, the third U.S. invasion of Haiti since World War II, Somalia, Honduras, Libya, Syria, Ukraine, Yemen, Iran, Nicaragua, and now Venezuela. Now, I don't know what criteria they used, but it doesn't have to necessarily be a shooting, open shooting war. It can just be U.S. troops on the ground, or it can just be CIA heavy, obvious CIA intervention through proxies, or U.S. intervention through proxies, as you saw in Syria. So Blum noted that the U.S. generally prefers what its planners call, that's kind of what I just got starting into, low-intensity conflict over full-scale wars. Only in periods of supreme overconfidence has it launched its most devastating and disastrous wars, from Korea and Vietnam to Afghanistan and Iraq. After its war of mass destruction in Iraq, the U.S. reverted to low-intensity conflict, quote-unquote, under Obama's doctrine of covert and proxy war. Obama conducted even heavier bombing than Bush, too, and deployed U.S. special operations forces to 150 countries all over the world, but he made sure that nearly all the bleeding and dying was done by Afghans, Syrians, Iraqis, Somalis, Libyans, Ukrainians, Yemenis, and others, not by Americans. What U.S. planners mean by, quote, low-intensity conflict is that it is less intense for Americans. So, for example, President Ghani of Afghanistan recently revealed that a staggering 45,000 Afghan security forces have been killed, 45,000 since he took office in 2014, compared with only 72 U.S. and NATO troops. Quote, it shows who has been doing the fighting, Ghani caustically remarked. This disparity is common to every current U.S. war. Anyway, this is a good article. Much more I wanted to say in it. It gets directly into Venezuela and some history on the Chavez time there. But we just don't have time to go into it. We're going to have to finish up. And you've been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And check us out on the archive function at WMFO.org. And look for a schedule, look for Socialist Alternative Radio. And we really want to thank feedback we've gotten on Facebook. We have a Facebook page called Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. And you can you can write to us there. And check out socialistalternative.org and socialistworld.net for the sign of the general politics of that we're putting forward here. Some of it's, you know, my personal opinion. Some of it's stuff I'm getting from Socialist Alternative and other places. But we urge you to, like we said at the beginning of the show, this isn't a show for just alternative information, although that's sorely needed from a left perspective, given the corporate media's dominance. But it's also a show, radio, a little moment here, supplemented hopefully by other things like Socialist Alternative's newspaper and a lot of other stuff, where we are encouraging you to get involved in the socialist movement. And there is such a thing as the socialist movement. There are socialist groups to get involved with, like Socialist Alternative. There are unions to help organize and get and join. There are groups that unfortunately are all too much single issue, but it's a start sometimes to get more involved politically and see the connections between all the issues happening in many different communities. And we urge you to find out more about socialism that connects all these things together in terms of their root causes as problems, but also their basic grassroots solutions that can be done to change things. So, for example, if you're wondering why we don't have national health care in this country, it's because it's linked to a general, if you have the general strength, you can't get it in as a single issue thing. You have to be taking on capitalism itself to get something like that. And other countries, movements have and parties, political parties to the left of the Democrats, for example, have done that, done those movements to try to change society. And in as a sort of part and parcel of that, get needed reforms, at least temporarily, hopefully. Unfortunately, they're temporary under capitalism. And that's what we need to do here. So until we have a more visible, a more mass movement for socialism, including for a workers' party of some sort, to be to the left of the two corporate parties, Democrats and Republicans, we are not going to get all these things that people are starting to list. So, for example, the Democratic Party primaries, one day they're for Medicare for all, the next day they're not. Pelosi and company just went against that. One day they're for taxing the rich, the next day they're not. They're going to raise our taxes. You know, that kind of thing. Anyway, keep up the struggle. Thanks a lot for listening. And check out socialistalternative.org. Check out Socialist Alternative on Facebook. And we'll see you in a couple weeks. And we'll go out with our, I'd say this is kind of our theme song. What are we, you know, we have a few different ones, but here you go.